on Saturday night, and I think it's December 7th. And it's been quite an enjoyable time I found in the monastery, having a bit of a refreshing, smaller community of monastics and guests. I told Ajahn Sidero that I don't think I had sat next to an Anagarika for almost a decade, and then there was one sitting right next to me. Not because I don't like Anagarikas, but just the more senior you get, you kind of move up in the line and don't have that kind of opportunity. So it's, yeah, it's been really nice having a small community. It's much more personal too, just seeing, sorry, like seeing a, you know, a small family, dealing with a small family, and greeting each other in the morning, and just, it feels quite spacious and pleasant. One of the themes that's been going around my head a little bit, and something I've been reflecting about, is, and I've taught about this before a little bit, but it's something that I believe Lumbar Pasano gave a teaching on to a young Obaso who was a monk here in the late 90s, so 1998 or 99. He was just a Berkeley First Tuesday, a Scot, and he's now married and has a daughter. There's some sort of thing he was speaking to Lumbar Pasano about, and Lumbar Pasano just suggested that he work with the experience of being misunderstood. I believe the words he used were being willing to be misunderstood. And that's an interesting thing, because often we might think that we don't really care so much about what others think of us, or it's not really a problem if we're misunderstood, especially if it's a situation where we haven't done anything that we think is worthy of criticism or blame. And the sense of, why does it matter if somebody thinks we are, then, you know, what's the problem with that kind of situation? Because all that matters is that we know that we have done only something wholesome, or done something in the correct way. And I remember when I was fairly young, I really believed that that was how it should be, that one shouldn't care about what others think. So there's two sides to that, of course, because if we go to the extreme of that and we really relate to others in a nonchalant way and we just think it doesn't matter what other people think of me, well, if we are doing everything wholesome, then for the most part that might work, although we might still step on some toes and harm people, because it inadvertently, even if we're doing the right thing, it doesn't always work out that it's harmless. So, you know, if somebody says to you, you know, like, oh, how do I look? You're like, oh, just honesty is important. You don't look too good. I think you should change what you're wearing and do something different, because, and on that is, it doesn't work. So honesty is not always something that's going to be a harmless thing to engage in. So in that situation, of course, one could just change a subject or try to do something. It doesn't mean one lies, but you can just ask, you know, why is it important what you think or whatever. But in other situations, you know, there are times when we can exaggerate the sense of like really caring about what other people think of us, what the problem is, you know, that there might be a problem that we're putting out there in the world and we want to try to rectify it. But the problem is that this is often related to an image of ourselves. We want to preserve our image in another person. Okay, I don't want this person to think poorly of me. I want them to think I'm a good person, and I wouldn't want them to think that I'm doing anything manipulative or controlling, like trying to influence them about how they think about me. So we find that it's actually a control issue. Again, we're trying to control something out there. And so this, you know, this comes up a lot. It comes up a lot, I find, just in my own experience, and I would guess in most people, it's just that sense of fear of judgment, fear of being wrong, worry about when we've done something wrong, if people think that we're a bad person or we're permanently just a terrible person. And so we worry. We worry about what others think. There's a story that I remember a then Ajahn Sanyumo telling about Master Hua. It was a Master Hua story from the city of 10,000 Buddhas. And there was a time, I think it might have been more early on in his teachings when he had some Western students, and he was teaching something either in a retreat way, or I'm not exactly sure what it was, but he was giving a teaching, and it was kind of understood at that time it wasn't appropriate. Let's say it was like the 8 precepts or something like that. It wasn't the time to eat. And this young man who was attending the retreat or attending his talk, day long, whatever it was, ended up buying like a really nice piece of, I'll have to just call it an apple pie. And so he had this really warm apple pie, and he was kind of, but he didn't have time to eat it because the talk was about to begin. So he had bought this, and then he came back for this talk. And so he put it in like a, I think he had like a pant pocket or one of those side pockets or something where you could slip it in there in a bag. And he was listening to Master Hua's talk, and he's just thinking about this apple pie. Just, oh, I can't wait to have this apple pie. It's just like so warm, and I'm so hungry. It's going to be so good. Wish I had some ice cream, but it's going to have to be good enough. And so this is what was going on during the talk. Hopefully you're not doing the same thing in this talk, but if you are, then maybe you're getting some more joy out of that, and good for you. But if not, then you can tune in again, or if you are. And what occurred was that the talk eventually finished, and there he is. He's finally got his moment. It's relief. Oh my goodness, it's finally finished. I can go find some place to have my apple pie. And I don't think he heard much about from the Dhamma talk, and he walks outside, and he's looking for a place where can he eat this with some privacy. And he sees, I think it was like, you know, like a two-story building, like a fire escape. So he goes kind of quickly up this fire escape, and he's, oh, at last. And he's standing there, and he starts to eat this apple pie, and he's just so, you know, just eating it kind of ravenously, like, oh, this is really good. Oh, I'm so happy I'm having this pie right now. And he's about halfway through the pie when all of a sudden, just out of his vision, he sees coming up that fire escape, Master Hua. And so he doesn't know what to do, and he's got this pie in his hand, so he shoves the entire thing in his mouth that's left over. And now his mouth is very full, and he begins to walk. He knows, oh, walking meditation, I'll do walking meditation. So he starts to walk around the top of this roof, and it's kind of a square. And then Master Hua is there, so Master Hua also begins to walk, but he walks in the opposite direction. So they're making these kind of loops past each other. You know, Master Hua is maybe on the inside, and he's on the outside. And so it's one time past him, and he doesn't feel like he can swallow because Master Hua is right there, and he doesn't want to look at him, but he thinks he might be watching him. So he's got this huge piece of pie in his mouth, and it's, you know, salivating, and it's just getting all mixed with his saliva, and it's becoming mush, and you can just imagine sweat beads coming down. And Master Hua is passing him, and they're passing each other. And then after the third or fourth pass, Master Hua stops right where he is, and he stops, and he's kind of, heart is pounding. And Master Hua looks at him and says, how does it feel? And then he immediately turns around towards the fire escape and walks down and disappears. And the young man is just kind of stupefied. He's just, wow. So he does finally swallow, I think. I mean, I'm not sure about that part of the story, but I assume he does. And I don't think his apple pie tastes very good anymore, since it's like half saliva. And he's just left there with that teaching. You know, how does it feel? The whole experience, you know, it's just this getting completely caught up in desire and then getting what he wanted and acting in a way that wasn't, you know, very beautiful, just wolfing it down in private, getting away from something, nobody can see him. And then Master Hua, the master right there, the one person that really, really didn't want to see at that moment, appears. And it's just this experience of not wanting to be caught and, you know, thinking about how poorly he looks in front of the teacher. How could he ever repair this situation? It just looks so bad. Obviously, a lot of probably negative views about himself. And then just this very simple teaching, how does it feel? And that's the beauty of the Buddha's teachings. That was the beauty of Master Hua's teaching in that moment. Master Hua didn't turn to him and say, you should be ashamed of yourself. He didn't say, you're a horrible person, you're a despicable person. You know, can't you follow the rules? Can't you do anything right? Whatever it might be that might have been going on in his own head for that young man, that Master Hua didn't say any of those things. It was just, how does it feel? And so as a reflection, just to bring this up in terms of this theme of being willing to be misunderstood, you know, how does it really affect you in your own practice when you think about how that might come up for you, how that is when that sense of being judged by another person or criticized by another person is something that Tan Himiko brought up. We see that as something we don't want to experience. Sorry, I brought it up this morning in a reflection. And it was just about criticism and using it as an opportunity. And with a lot of us, the sense of criticism is we don't want to feel criticism from anyone. We don't want to, it's just not something, it's a worldly wind. We want to avoid it at all costs. I guess there are some people in the world who might say, I love criticism, just give it to me. Tell me how much you hate me, how terrible I am. And of course, we might appreciate something when somebody says something in the right way, but it's very hard. It's very hard to hear it because it's rare that it is said in the perfect way that we can hear it. Which is why the Buddha encouraged us to, whenever we do think there's something that somebody has something to say to us about our behavior that is valuable, then the Buddha says, actually, you should treat that like a gem. But mostly, I think most human beings don't. They more treat it like excrement. I don't want to be associated with this. I want to get away from it. It's like something that smells very terrible. And we don't want to have anything to do with it. And so with this theme about being misunderstood, that's what often can come up in the mind. It's like I've done something wrong. And the interesting aspect of that is that we're criticizing ourselves, but we're also assuming others are being critical of us, or they know what's up, or they think what's up, or they must think this about me. But that the reason Lumpur told Scott at the time, be willing to be misunderstood, is that there's a problem with us going to great lengths to try to essentially cover up our unwholesome behavior by explaining it away to someone else. Now, sometimes it's very important to explain something to someone. If there's been a genuine misunderstanding where someone was, again, as I started the talk, talking about harming someone in some way, then yeah, there's always a reason to apologize or try to make amends. But often what we do in that situation is something very similar. We say, I'm sorry I said that, but you really deserved it. I shouldn't have said that, but you know, it's something you really should have heard. And so that's not an apology at all, is it? When we're telling somebody the reason that we said something is actually okay, that's not a regret. That's actually saying, yeah, it was right for me to do that. So somehow using the word sorry in that way doesn't work. So I think one has to be very careful about the genuineness of what we're doing when we're seeking to explain ourselves to someone else. You know, are we doing that for them or are we doing that for us? And it can be very tempting to try to explain ourselves away. I see this every day, not every day, but mostly every day. I'll have some food left in my bowl. And this is something that I've had as a continuing defilement. I think even when I was a kid, I just always kind of took more than I could eat. And then it's like, I do try to do something about it. Sometimes it's all right. sometimes I'm like, yeah, okay, I did it. There's nothing left. Or just a couple of bites or whatever. But then since I've been an Ajahn, there's always someone coming up and collecting my bowl. And so I look down, oh God, I did it again. And the person comes up to my bowl and one of the junior members, and I just think, oh, this is embarrassing. Jeez, I'm supposed to be an inspiration. And I'm sure their bowl is completely empty. And they're just seeing this monk who's just taking too much again. And it's probably stuff that they wanted to eat. And so then I'm there and I'm thinking like, okay, I'm trying not to say anything. So, oh, did it again or whatever it was. Something sometimes comes out and that's not for them. I recognize it's for me. It's like, oh, don't think poorly of me. And that's the conundrum that we face whenever we're trying to explain ourselves. The sense of like, is it for the other person or is it for us? And I think we need to be very careful because it's much more helpful in our Dhamma practice in situations like that to identify, okay, if it's not for the other person, I'm not speaking for the help of the other person, then if it's for me, can I recognize that and at least stop myself to experience exactly what Master Hua said? How does it feel? You know, how does it feel to whatever it is, hold myself in contempt or continue to repeat the same mistake over and over again? You know, how does that particularly feel? What is that like? And that is the Buddha's teaching. That is the teaching that we follow. We're not actually taking on a practice to mortify ourselves, to torture ourselves. But that's often what we're doing with our own criticism or holding ourselves in a particular way without seeing that, oh, actually examining the examined life. This is exactly what we're trying to do, is to look at our experience. And this is very obvious. This is very obvious why we're doing this practice. But it's easy, so easy to miss. It's so easy to miss. So I think one of the things that's very helpful is to look anytime we're explaining ourselves to another person and to really ask ourselves, you know, okay, do I need to do this? Is this, what's the intention here? What is my intention? There's another Master Hua story that's coming to mind. And it's not so much a story, but it's something that he would do to his disciples that I understand I was told about this particular way of teaching. And he would basically say something to one of his students. And what he'd say to the student was basically asking them why they did a particular action. So he'd say, you know, why did you do this thing? And the thing that he would ask about was something that wasn't right. It wasn't a good thing. It was a mistake, but it was usually something that not just was an innocent mistake. It was like somebody trying to get away with something or do something that was obviously not very beautiful behavior. And so he'd ask a person about that. And it's possible that he was actually asking about a very specific thing that he saw, but he didn't see that person do it. He saw somebody else do it. And he would ask the person who he didn't see do it why they did it. And then he would see their reaction. And the reaction was telling him where the student was, you know. Oh, that wasn't me. I didn't do that. I mean, that was him, you know. That's, you didn't know that. I'm sorry, but it wasn't me. And so it was like, oh, okay, interesting. But someone who's willing to be misunderstood just might just kind of, sorry, master. And that's it. And then how does it feel? So I'm just thinking about things that occur here, and like at least my training with Lumpur Pasno, there were so many times where he was teaching in this way. He wasn't quite the teddy bear he is now. And what I mean by that is when I trained with him, the first time I met him, I only got to know him for a few months, and then he went off for a year and 3-month sabbatical. And so I actually mostly trained with Ajahn Amaro during that time. It was just Ajahn Amaro here as the sole abbot, and then Lumpur came back. And I noticed that I appreciated Ajahn Amaro. I really enjoyed him as a teacher in many ways. But there are other ways where, which is very common, one can kind of be like, well, the teacher's job is to not allow you to always get what you want. And so when that happens, frustration can occur. And so some of those frustrations I had with Ajahn Amaro, then I would say like, well, Lumbar Pasana is coming back. And even though they were co-abbots, I was like, well, this is going to be, he's going to be great. And when he came back, for some reason, I just thought he was this just, he is a very sweet human being, but he also can be fierce. And what a lot of his students now see who aren't here with him as the abbot is that, yeah, he didn't sugarcoat things. And sometimes I would be told quite directly when I was not doing something that was really in my own best interest, nor in the interest of others. And the encouragement wasn't to explain to him like, well, okay, well, let me try to explain to you so you understand. That made things a lot worse because he pretty much already did understand. And so then he would either listen to this or not listen to this, or the main teaching around that was, you know, you don't need to explain this to me. I've given you a teaching. So you need to explain it to yourself. You need to look at what my teaching was teaching you. And there were many times I missed it because I was so focused on making sure that I just didn't look like an idiot in front of him. Like, okay, I think you might have gotten this wrong, which made me look like even more of an idiot. And it was often, some of the other monks, I think, found this funny, especially, you know, as I was an Anagarika and in Samanera and Navakan, Majima, and Ajahn. So, yeah, it happened. But he did assure me that it would happen less and less, and that was correct. Or at least he corrects me a lot less. But the thing about this teaching was that it was very difficult to be with experiences where I could be in some situations where genuinely I felt I was misunderstood, that I actually hadn't done something. And I was in other experiences where I just didn't want him to think that I had done something poorly. Not that I was lying, but I was like, oh, I gotta, you know, I wanted to somehow downplay it, like just not make myself look that bad. And the interesting thing about both of those is that they're both just teachings in whatever way he was teaching me, I could watch. I could see, okay, there was a misunderstanding. What does that feel like? What's that experience? How can I learn from that? You know, can I develop equanimity? Can I lose that desire to make sure that I'm understood, to insist that I'm understood? And in other ways, how can I learn from my own, you know, weasel mind that's trying to get the situation right so I don't look so bad? So I'm not sure if any of you have anything in common with this, but any time that we tend to deal with human beings, I appreciated one time hearing a teacher in some way say something like, you don't have to worry about other human beings and how they think about you, because whenever you're dealing with any human beings, they're just as neurotically afraid and worried about how you're thinking about them than you are doing the same thing with them. So just don't worry about it. And in a way, it's right. You know, you think about, like, obviously people have different levels of this, but to a certain evolutionary degree, we had to be careful around other people. We never knew who was friend or foe. And even family members could be friend or foe. So we didn't necessarily always know who we could count on. And so I think this is built in an almost innate way. So it takes a lot of de-evolving to a certain way in terms of the negative aspect of it, taking out the negative fruits of evolution in this way so that we can sort of learn to trust in our own awareness and our own experience around others so that we're not obsessively worried about what others think about us. And so that's part of the work. That's part of this experience of how does it feel? Because our work, our path is to really have a sense of I can work with this in a different way. It's not through trying to control my external experience, trying to control others' perception of me. It's by letting go of my own perception of self, not creating and solidifying and becoming. so that I'm eventually able to let go of that and transcend the suffering that it's creating. So these are opportunities that we have that we sometimes just don't see, because we might jump through hoops to try to, in a way, control or manipulate our experience so that in our own perception, nobody finds fault with us. The irony in all of this is that I think most people, they have a sense of what's going on. You know, when you're not genuine and you're just looking after your own self-interest, there's something that kind of, I think, oozes out of a person. It kind of comes out and the other person just like sees it. And so it doesn't take a lot to kind of to see this sort of weaseling attempt at getting oneself out of essentially looking like one's guilty. And so what I say is ironic about it is if we just kind of shut up and we're like, okay, I'm just going to allow this to be how it is, to let others think of me as they will and try not to get too involved with that or worry about it. And obviously if there's something that somebody's misunderstanding that's actually causing duress for them in terms of their being hurt, or also like maybe losing faith, you know, something, for example, if somebody thinks you stole something and you know, there are definite reasons why we want to explain to somebody why something like that didn't occur. But we need to each of us examine for ourselves, what are those reasons? What are our motivations? What are we doing this for when we're seeking to explain ourselves to another person? And when we see that it is just in our own self-interest, self-preservation to make our image of ourselves appear good within other people, because we are just very afraid of the consequences of looking bad, we see that there might be vanity there, then it's really important to just learn how to experience that. What is that? What does that feel like when I don't act on that impulse? What does it feel like when I am willing to be misunderstood? So these are just some reflections tonight. And if anything's been helpful, then please reflect on it and use it in your own practice. And anything else that hasn't been so useful, just feel free to leave it behind.